possible, spoken the narrations about Prithu Maharaj, which enrich one's devotional attitude. Whoever takes advantage of these benefits, also goes back home at the garden like Maharaj. So please repeat. The great sage Maitreya continued, My dear Vidura, I have, as far as possible, spoken the narrations about Prithu Maharaj, which enrich one's devotional attitude. Whoever takes advantage of these benefits also goes back home to Godhead, like Maharaj Prithu. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. The word Shravayat, mentioned in a previous verse, indicates that one should not only read for himself, but should also induce others to read and hear. That is called preaching. One should also induce others to read and hear. That is called preaching. An interesting definition of preaching. When you induce others to hear and to read, that's preaching. We tend to think it means, it's inducing. Inducing, inspiring, attracting, bringing forth one's desire to read and hear. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu recommended this practice, Yare Deka Tarekaha Krishna Upadesh, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Maja 7.1.2.8. Quote, whomever you meet, simply talk with him about the instructions given by Krishna, or tell him of the narrations about Krishna. Tell him the instructions given by Krishna and the narrations about Krishna. Not necessarily both at one time. Some people can hear good advice, but if they think it's coming from God, they don't want to hear it. Other people, if they think it's coming from God, they want to hear more. And other people don't want to hear the instructions from God, but the stories about God, those are okay. So any of those three, A, B, or A and B combined, according to time, place, and circumstance. Prithu Maharaj's history and devotional service is as potent as narrations about the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should not make distinctions between the pastimes of the Lord and the activities of Prithu Maharaj. And whenever it is possible, a devotee should induce others to hear about Prithu Maharaj. One should not only read of his pastimes for one's own benefit, but should induce others to read and hear about them also. In this way, everyone can be benefited. Jai Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. All the Ganatanya Nishajanam Anjana Shalakaya Chakshurvani Tamiyan Tasmai Shri Guru Maha Shri Tetanamano Vishtam Stapitami in the Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dagatis Pakadam Tika Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasani Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram 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 Hare. So I don't know everybody here, so I should just briefly introduce. My name is Anup Dhamma. I'm visiting just for one day from Washington, D.C. I'm going to a conference with Mahaprabhu, just in case anyone was thinking. Great Chaitanya is not here, Mahaprabhu is not here, other people, so maybe some of the leaders weren't there, some stranger snuck up on a seat. Give class. I was invited to give class. You don't have to stay, but I was invited to give class. Okay. Nice to see everybody here. I always like coming here. I was thinking this morning, for my taste, this baby, it definitely is one of the most beautiful temple rooms in the movement. It's not the biggest, but it's very beautiful. It's very peaceful. Of course, the deities are particularly very, very beautiful. So I was nice to visit here. I was looking at the list of speakers too. You did such a musty Vaishnavas over the last month. chanted in the Swamiya all the time, in Radhika Raman, and Vipamoya, and Pagosh, Ramai Swami, Satyananda Swami, he had like 4 or 5 classes. So, yeah. One of your best months, yeah. I'm sorry it's not going to finish with a bang. I'm trying to say a couple of things. So, we're finishing this chapter on Maharaj Prita. In fact, actually finishing the whole section, multiple chapters. This whole second part of the fourth canto, beginning in this chapter 20, it seems I didn't have time to pull the other book up, it seems a few chapters previous to this, is all about Maharaj Prita. So there's lots and lots and lots of study about Maharaj Prita. So ending this study of his life, his teachings, his struggles, his success, and his ultimate glory in going back to Godhead. His life is considered so especially auspicious that it's described in lengthy sections of the Bhagavatam, and then at the end we're told how we should try to study this, and that we should read this. Today's verse is telling us that whoever takes advantage of the benefits of hearing the narrations, so it's described, there's many, many benefits of hearing these narrations, and then tomorrow we'll end with one last glorification of the benefit of hearing about Maharaj Prita. So that's the conclusion of all these chapters. So it's being described how we should try to hear about this great devotee. And it actually begins in text 31. So I'm going to start by just rereading this long list of benefits that one receives. And it's kind of like a smorgasbord of benefits. You can get a kingdom, you can get so many things. So pay attention, because you'll get these benefits if you listen attentively. Any person who describes, and this is my journey concluding, any person who describes the great characteristics of King Prita with faith and determination, whether he reads or hears of them or helps others to hear of them, is certain to attain the very planet which Maharaj Prita attained. In other words, such a person also returns home to the Vaikuntha planets, back to Godhead. So we just have to hear with faith and determination, according to this verse. If one hears of the characteristics of Prita Maharaj and is a Brahmana, one becomes perfectly qualified with brahminical powers. If he is a Kshatriya, he becomes a king of the world. If he is a Vaishya, he becomes a master of other Vaishyas and many animals. And if he is a Shudra, he becomes the topmost devotee. Prabhupada comments, a person born in a Shudra family can become greater than a Brahmana simply by accepting devotional service and giving oral reception to the pastimes of the Lord. Just one little snippet from the purport. And then text 33, it does not matter whether one is a man or a woman. Anyone who with great respect hears this narration of Prita Maharaj will become the father of many children. If he is without children, then will become the richest of men if he is without money. Also, one who hears this narration 3 times will become very reputable if he is not recognized in society. And he will become a great scholar if he is illiterate. In other words, hearing of the narrations of Prita Maharaj is so auspicious that it drives away all bad luck. By hearing the narrations of Prita Maharaj, one can become great, increase his duration of life, gain promotion to the heavenly planets, and counteract the contaminations of the age of Kali. It's quite a list, isn't it? You might want to go back and reread the last 3 months worth of Bhagavatam verses. Make sure you paid attention with faith and determination to get the benefit. In addition, one can promote the causes of religion, economic development, sense gratification, and liberation. Therefore, from all sides, it is advisable for a materialistic person who is interested in such things, as listed above, to read and hear the narrations of the life and character of Prita Maharaj. If a king was desirous of attaining victory and ruling power, chants the narration of Prita Maharaj three times before going forth on his chariot, all subordinate kings will automatically render all kinds of taxes unto him as they render them under Maharaj Prita, simply upon his order. So before you go out in your chariot the next time, you should chant this three times. Then it's more directly in line with what we're trying to do. Yesterday's verse. A pure devotee who is executing the different processes of devotional service may be situated in the transcendental position, being completely absorbed in Krishna consciousness. But even he, while discharging devotional service, must hear, read, and induce others to hear about the character and life of Prita Maharaj. And then today's verse, the great sage Maitreya continued, my dear Vidura, I have as far as possible spoken the narrations about Prita Maharaj, which enrich one's devotional attitude. So I'm going to talk mostly about it. Whoever takes advantage of these benefits also goes back home, back to Godhead, like Maharaj Prita. So all this long list of material benefits, everywhere from becoming rich and becoming famous and having all the kings surrender to you, becoming the father of many children, and being free from all bad luck. You could go to Las Vegas and set up a booth outside and say, stop here, read these three times, all your bad luck will go away. All the way up to that, it says, even a pure devotee should read these. And then in today's verse it says, by doing so it enriches one's devotional attitude. And then by taking advantage, one goes back home, back to God, and just like Prita Maharaj. So these last two verses mostly apply to us. We're trying to be devotees. Everyone's a devotee. Some people are trying to forget Krishna. Some people are trying to remember Krishna. And some people, like many of us, we're struggling somewhere in between. I like to remember Krishna, and sometimes the benefits seem to outweigh the disadvantages, perceived disadvantages, and sometimes the perceived disadvantages, sometimes they seem to overwhelm the benefits. That's when we lose our enthusiasm for Krishna consciousness. So here it's explained how by this hearing process we can enrich our devotional attitude, we can go back to God. And so this is actually very important for us, this question of attitude. We understand in the Bhagavad Gita, Prakrite Krimanani Gunai Karmani Sarashaha Ahankara Vimudatma Kartaham Iti Manite. The bewildered spirit soul under the influence of the three modes of material nature thinks himself to be doer of activities which in actuality are carried out by me alone, ultimately by Krishna. So, we're not the doers. So like, what do we do? Doesn't you wonder sometimes, well, it's not really me baking the bread or cleaning the floor or doing the arctic or giving the class or, you know, what can I do? What do I do? What contributions can I make? So really what we can do is desire. It's our attitude that this is the most important. So here it's explained how by hearing about Prita Maharaj, our devotional attitude can be enriched. So the importance of this devotional attitude is mentioned many, many places. Just a few things came to mind just as I was preparing. In the Nectar of Instruction, Upadeshamrita describes, I don't know the Sanskrit, I'm sure some of you do, but Utsaha, how's the whole verse going? Utsaha means enthusiasm. How's that verse going? You can always tell when we don't know verses really well. We kind of go, utsaha, nishtayat. I should know, we shall know, it's an important verse. But anyway, the three words I want to translation at least. First, utsaha means enthusiasm. It's describing what six things contribute to the complete perfection of our devotional service. Devotional service can be achieved if we have, and it starts out with three things directly related to attitude. First one being enthusiasm. And Prabhupada, in the purport of that text, he describes enthusiasm as endeavoring with intelligence. You know, sometimes we think enthusiasm means like you feel good. Right? Somebody's sometimes enthusiastic about something, they feel good about it. Somehow the example comes to mind of years and years and years ago, one devotee was becoming a new devotee and his wife was coming to visit the temple for the first time, and I remember I was a brahmachari, so I might have been a little inimical to his enthusiasm, I'm not sure it's possible. But I remember he was really enthusiastic that his wife was coming. But as it turned out, they didn't have a very good relationship. They ended up being separated, divorced at just some point in time. So his enthusiasm, which was so high, later was really low. So enthusiasm doesn't just mean you're feeling how you feel about something, but it's endeavoring with intelligence. Intelligence means sometimes you feel good about something, sometimes you don't feel good about something, but you do it anyway. Just like sometimes you have to take some medicine. Sometimes the medicine tastes good. Some medicines taste really, really good. Other medicines, they don't taste so good. But if you're intelligent, you take the medicine whether it tastes good or doesn't taste good. If you know it's good medicine, it works. You'll take it whether it tastes good or not. So the same way, sometimes we may feel enthusiastic, but it's not so much how we feel, it's we act with enthusiasm. So that's a manifestation of a devotional, the attitude that's being described here. Also it says one should be confident. Endeavoring with enthusiasm, confident, and what's the third one on that list? Patience. Yeah, depending on the motives of nature that we're affected by, some of those are harder or easier. Some of us, enthusiasm is really easy, but the patience is tough. Some of us, confidence is really easy, but the enthusiasm is tough. Some of us, the enthusiasm is really easy, but the patience is tough. But we have to try and develop all three. So those are three mentioned in that scripture that are important for us to be successful in terms of our attitude and devotional service. In other words, it's not just that we, sometimes you hear this expression, going through the motions. Sometimes people go to work and they just go through the motions. They have the machine, they punch their card, and they're kind of a dead body there for 8 hours, and then they punch the card and they go home. So they're going through the motions. Sometimes a student goes to class and they sit in the back, they're in the room, they're looking out the window, they're like, physically they're there, but they're not really there. Their mind is somewhere else. So, we have to have the right attitude and not just go through the motions. In the Bhagavad Gita, many references, but a couple, Krishna tells Arjuna, he says, because you're good looking, therefore I'm going to give you the Bhagavad Gita knowledge, right? Because you're highborn, because you're related to me, right? It's a family connection, right? Because you're rich, because you're famous, because you have a nice chariot. What's he say? Why is he giving him the Bhagavad Gita? Because something related to his attitude. Yeah, because you're my friend. Another verse he says, because you are never envious of me. Therefore, I'm going to reveal the secrets of Bhagavad Gita. Of course, our problem is we're envious. At least, we may not understand that so well. But the acharyas explained to us, our Vaishnava philosophy rests on this point. We somehow develop this envy of Krishna, so we come here. So, sometimes we think, well, I'm not envious of Krishna. I love Krishna. I like Krishna. Krishna's wonderful. It's Vishnu Das I'm envious of, or Krishna Das, or Radha Dasi. I don't like her, she's puffed up. Just because she knows I'm the same better than everybody else, why should she get to sing all the time? I can sing as good as she can. But the bad news is she can't sing as big like Krishna can. So if we think we're envious of her or him, they're just a speck. Krishna's a million billion times richer, more beautiful, more famous, more well known. You know, we may think, well, you know, why does he get such importance? Some other person we're a little envious of. But actually, that person is nothing. So it is Krishna. There's some envy in our heart for Krishna. We're trying to clean that. So this attitude, again, Krishna says, very important, this attitude. And then Lord Chaitanya, did Lord Chaitanya talk about attitude being very important in devotional service? And what did he say in the Shashastika? He said, you can chant. Whatever mood you're in, it's okay. Just chant. Yeah. Yeah. So what's the mood supposed to be for him? He says your attitude needs to be what? One of, you should feel proud that you're doing it.
Not to feel lower than the grass.
Yeah, lower than the grass. Yeah, I went to see the horse yesterday. I was pulling grass to feed the horse, and I realized I'm pulling. Some of it's breaking, some of it the roots coming up, and I thought, okay, I'm actually killing this grass. And I know that's very good. I should try to bend lower, use two hands or something. But then the grass, it didn't scream or complain. It just pulled right up. So we're supposed to be more tolerant, more lower, feel ourselves lower than the grass. It's about to get fed to the pony. That's not a very glorious finish, to get fed to the pony. But the grass accepts that. So, right? And what kind of mood? A humble state of mind. A humble state of mind. Offering to others what?
All
respect. So those are attitude questions. Attitude ideas here. And in the third canto, one other thought that comes to mind. I think third canto, Kunti, third canto.
First canto, chapter.
First canto. Oh, that's right. First canto, part three, in the old way it was printed. Okay, thank you. Yeah. And she is describing, this one verse was talking about the glories of chanting the holy name. And explains that just by chanting, all success can be achieved. And Prabhupada writes in the purport, he says, this is not an exaggeration, but there's this much potency. Just once chanting the holy name of the Lord will be completely purified, attained love of God. He says, but, sometimes there's a but, there's a condition. There's a quality to the chanting. And he says, one has to chant with feeling we call out. I think he also explains it just as he does in other places. One has to call out to Krishna like the child calling for their mother. So there's a mood there, there's an attitude we have to have. And in tomorrow's verse, I'm going to cheat twice and steal a little bit from tomorrow's verse. So here's the first time. The text itself says, whoever with great reverence and adoration regularly reads, chants, and describes the history of Preetamara's activities will certainly increase unflinching faith and attraction for the lotus feet of the Lord. So here, quality of Dasha Shivaka. So again, attitude is emphasized. If one is reading and chanting and hearing with reverence and adoration, then these results can come. You can conquer all the kings, you can be free from bad luck, you can be the father of many children, you can go back to Vaikuntha. But the attitude has to be there. So, all these different great benefits can be achieved. Krishna also, the Bhagavad Gita says, as they surrender to me, I reward them accordingly. So we can understand that also means attitude. If we're chanting sincerely, if we're serving sincerely, then Krishna says, okay, then I reward accordingly. So I read all this, I don't know how the rest of you feel, but I kind of read this and I think, okay, I'm finished. There's no hope. Because I'm not very enthusiastic. I'm not very patient. I don't feel very confident. I don't chant like a child crying for its mother. I don't feel very respectful to others, and on and on and on. I don't feel that way. So here Krishna is saying it's very easy. You just have to have the quality. But I'm thinking, I don't have the quality. Isn't there something a little more mechanical that I maybe could do? Maybe I can, you know, give a donation or chant a few mantras or, you know, accept some saving grace of someone who will take charge of me or something like that. But here it's simple, but it's difficult. The process is simple, but sometimes the obstacles are great. So I remember, I can't give an exact reference on this, I've never looked it up, it's probably in the database, but there's a tape I heard a few times, listened to it a few times to make sure, because I thought it was a very important instruction. Prabhupada was explaining that he said you should chant sincerely, and then everything will come. Again, attitude. Attitude has to be there. We're saying there's so much potency in the Hare Krishna mantra. If you just chant sincerely, then everything will come. And then he paused for a moment. And he said, what sincerely? If you just chant, sincerity will come. Very nice instruction. That was kind of like one of those experiences for me when I said, you know, there's hope. I can stay. I might make it after all. But he said that. He said, if you just chant sincerely, everything will come. So that's been described here. If we have this devotional mood, respect, humility, enthusiasm, if we have those qualities, then Krishna guarantees our success. Or Chaitanya guarantees our success. Maitreya guarantees our success. But then you think about it, I don't have those qualities. So Prabhupada said, if we just chant, it will come. That will come. The process itself, the beginning, we may not be in the right mood, we may not have the right attitude, but if we engage in devotional service, then the mood will come. And of course, the more we understand, then the more we can try to develop that mood, the more we can try to be conscious of that. There's a little exchange I read a little while ago. It was, I believe, one of the memory tapes. One of the early days. And again, a nice story that I find gives me some inspiration on these points. When, in the early days in New York, Garga Muni Prabhu, I think previous to initiation, he was coming, and his brother, Brahmananda, and other devotees, early in New York, was coming. And they were just learning to pay obeisances to Prabhupada. And Garga Muni didn't like the idea of paying obeisances to Prabhupada, so he didn't bow down. Everybody else would bow down, but he didn't bow down. And Prabhupada never said a thing, didn't say a thing. And then one day, he mentioned it to Prabhupada. He said, Swamiji, in those days, he said, Swamiji, the others bow down when they come to see you, but I don't bow down. Is that all right? He said, I don't feel like it. And Prabhupada told him, he said, that's okay. If you bow down, then the feeling will come. So he was saying, I don't want to do it. I don't feel like it. Assuming that you have to kind of manifest the devotion before you should engage in the devotion. Prabhupada said, no. If you act, using, again, endeavor with intelligence, if upon hearing the proper process, method, behavior, if we act on that intelligence, then the feeling will come. So again, we may not have the right attitude, but if we endeavor in that way, then the attitude will come. The purification, the process, right? Prabhupada talks all the time about the process of devotional service. Just like in science classes, you take some chemistry classes, there's a process. You go to a lab. You have a laboratory. I remember I took one chemistry class. That's all I could handle. But they would lecture for 2-3 days a week, and the other 2 days you go in the laboratory. So they would tell you, if you do this and this and this, if you combine these different elements, this is the result. So then they tell you that on Monday, you read about it in your book on Monday night, you go home, and on Tuesday you go into the laboratory, you put in your goggles to make sure nothing goes wrong, and you add the things together, and it explodes, or it bubbles, or it crusts up, or it turns color, or whatever, and you see, oh, it didn't work. Now, you may not have the right attitude. See, somebody who really knows, they might get excited. They go into the laboratory, oh, I know, I'm going to put these things together, and I'm going to produce something very valuable. We may not have so much of the neophyte may not have so much enthusiasm because they're not really convinced, but they're convinced enough that they'll practice it, they'll apply it. And when they apply it, then the result comes. So that's the process that's given. So then also tomorrow's verse, one last section I'll steal from here. Prabhupada says, find my piece. Yes. By hearing the chanting of the glories of the Lord or the Lord's devotee, one can become firmly fixed in the service of the lotus feet of the Lord. So this is by the process. We may not be so fixed. We're not so fixed. But by the process of hearing and chanting, the enthusiasm comes, the insight comes, the realization comes, and being fixed comes. In the earlier verse, text 11, the same section here describes a similar point. By regularly discharging devotional service, Prithu Maharaj became transcendental in mind and could therefore constantly think of the lotus feet of the Lord. Because of this, He became completely detached and attained perfect knowledge by which he could transcend all doubt. I was reading a book yesterday. I flew over from Washington, D.C. I was reading a book yesterday morning about it's a sociologist. They did some study on religion and American people's opinions. American people's opinion on religion. I was reading through one section, and it was something about doubt. And they were saying something. One option was, I believe in something like this. I believe in God without any doubts. And then the next one was, I have some doubts. The next one was, like, I have a lot of doubts, and then I don't believe in God, and then like that. So I was looking, I was trying to think, okay, how am I going to answer this? Some doubts sounds really weak, like you have a lot of doubts. But I was thinking, but I don't think I could say, you know, if somebody asked me that, I'd really struggle with it. So I believe in God free from all doubts. That sounds like a really big word, all. And I was thinking of the one pastime in prophet, he was with some of his senior devotees, and he was questioning them. He was saying, so do you have any doubts? And he said, I have none. I have none. So what about you? He was pushing them like that. So are you free from doubts? Have you become purified yet? So in the survey, I was thinking, So I was thinking, maybe there should be some category between maybe free from almost all doubts. That I could check. Some doubts, like, that doesn't sound very good. All doubts, I don't know. So it's described here, Preacher Maharaj, he transcended all doubt. How? How did he do it? What did he explain? By doing what? By regularly discharging devotional service. By regularly discharging devotional service. So, also in the Bhagavad Gita, 10th chapter, 7th verse, right? Krishna tells Arjuna, you may know that verse, 10:7. Etam vibhutam yogam cha mava yoga veti tattvataha so vikalpena yogena yujate natma samshayaha. One who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mind engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So he also talks about this being factually convinced. So sometimes we think, like, okay, being a devotee means you're convinced, 100% convinced, no doubts. But actually, being a devotee means being convinced you want to become convinced. Really. And as we practice devotional service, then that conviction becomes stronger and stronger. And meanwhile, we're also becoming more and more convinced that the material energy is not an option. As is described in the Ishopanishad, one should cultivate knowledge of nescience and transcendence side by side. Just like when I was leaving the United States, the whole country was kind of like a little traumatized because three very big Hollywood type people died in 1 week. First, this person named Ed McMahon, you probably never heard of, but he was a co-host of this night show, the Tonight Show, Johnny Carson, maybe you heard of Johnny Carson. It was like, I mean, when I was a little boy, my aunt would go to sleep at night watching Johnny Carson. And she died about 15 years ago, 80, so this seemed like it was forever, a long time ago. He was on TV for 25 years. People watched the show late at night. So the co-host of this show just died. So that was like Monday. And then Tuesday, some woman who was now 62 died of some cancer or something, who was a big Hollywood star, a beautiful young woman in the 70s. Yes. I wasn't going to say her name, but since you did, we should give her full credit, yes. Farrah Fawcett, yes. Right, I didn't, yeah. Yeah, I was in the 70s, so I knew about Farrah Fawcett. Yes. So anyway, but so then she died. And then Michael Jackson, yeah, just a few days ago. So the whole country's in trauma about these, because like if you're 80 years old, like, oh my gosh, Ed McMahon died. If you're 50, 60 years old, oh my gosh, Farrah Fawcett died. if you're 30 or 40, oh my God, Michael Jackson died. And they were saying the only one that's not disturbing people under 20, they're like, what's the big deal? Who cares? All these old fogies died. But Michael Jackson in particular, I don't know what's happened the last 2 days, but there are all these questions. Why did he die? How did he die? Did the doctor have something to do with it? But the one thing they determined is they know that he took lots and lots of pain prescription drugs. And I read an article that was interesting because it was written by an African-American columnist, and I think maybe he was more at liberty to challenge this than maybe someone who's not African-American. But he was talking about how because of his dislike of his body, that he went through, I think they said something like at least 10 different operations on his nose. Many operations, trying to make his skin lighter and so many things. But his nose alone, I think he said something like 10. So there's nothing left. And they were saying when you do these things, you know, eventually problems, complications. So he was taking so many pain pills and prescription drugs and things to deal with the pain. So he was so famous, and I think like the biggest selling record album in history or something like that. And so famous, but miserable life. You know, now it's all coming out. And, you know, there's going to be some question, did he have something to do with his own death? I don't know what, how it's going to end up. But either way, 50 years old, he's dead, he's gone. So much fame, so much power, so much wealth, so much opulence, money, people adoring him. And I was sitting in the airport. Nowadays in America, they have TV sets in the airport everywhere. You have to you can't find a place without a TV set. So I was just trying to read it. They were talking about how there was some story came up about how his life also is proof of how horrible it is to be famous. Prabhupada talks about that, like Mahatma Gandhi in his last years, wherever he went, he couldn't even sleep. Because there'd be crowds outside his window all night long. Mahatma Gandhi, King Jai, Mahatma Gandhi, King Jai. He's so great, but he can't get a night of peace. One peaceful night's rest. So famous like that, it makes people's lives very, very, very painful. And what was it? Diana, right? She died in a car accident.
Paris.
Yeah, racing to try to get away from all the photographers.
Paparazzi.
Yeah, paparazzi. Yeah. Yeah, so many, right? They're just so you become, everybody wants to be, I mean, not everybody, but a lot of times, a lot of people, they want to be famous, well-known for whatever they do, but if you become a little too famous, then it becomes torturous. And everybody likes to be beautiful, but I mean, you know, I worked as a bartender before I became a devotee. And I remember the prettiest waitress's work was hell. Because all the drunken people would, you know, harass them. And sometimes I've seen in a grocery store line, she'd buy something, stand in line, and then it turns out there's a very, very beautiful girl who's checking you out. You know, I have a male body and I'm free from those conceptions of life, so you look up, you could care less who's behind the counter, you look up, it's a very, very beautiful girl. Oh. And then you notice everybody in line is being very friendly to her. So because she's beautiful, everybody's friendly. But she's got to be thinking, who's really my friend? Is it? And George Harrison talked about when he became very famous and wealthy, he said, you never know who's your friend. They just like you because you have money or you have some power or something like that. And as soon as you don't have those things, they cast you away. One last story, in Washington, D.C., when I became first moved to Washington, D.C., I saw one newspaper article. They were interviewing a woman whose husband was a congressman. So he was like parliament, and he was very powerful. He was head of some committee or something like that. And she was saying that the elections were on Tuesday. She said, on Monday, we run everybody's what they call A-list. Like they want you to come to the party. You know, if you have some social event, you want other big people, you want some Supreme Court justices and some politicians. So on Monday night she was on the A-list. Everybody wanted her to come to the parties. She was big. Everybody opened the doors for her. On Tuesday her husband lost the election. So he no longer has no position, no power, no influence. She said, literally, quote unquote from this article, on Wednesday, Monday I'm on the A list, Tuesday was the election, she said, on Wednesday, my best friend would not return my phone call. Because the power was gone. So who cares? So that's the nature of material experience. And it's not just that we sit and we're like in some kind of closed doors. We talk about how bad those people are, those things. We see it. We live in the world. You know, you read the thing, Michael Jackson, they're asking, maybe he died because the fame killed him. Or because of his discomfort with his own body, tortured himself, chopping himself up so many times. You know, this is very difficult, unfortunate situation. So, therefore, it's described the best use of our time in our life is to hear and chant about the Lord. Explains in Bhagavad Gita, those who are intelligent, they take refuge in Krishna. They want to hear and chant about Krishna because by so doing, our hearts become cleansed and we become liberated. I'm out of time, so I won't go into the second point. But I was talking also, we shouldn't just do this for ourselves. We should do it for the benefit of others. As Krishna's devotees, as Vaishnavas, we shouldn't discriminate. Everybody's the Lord's devotee, and therefore we should also be shravayant, indicating not just reading for ourselves, but to try to benefit others according to our capacity, to try to give others the opportunity to hear and to chant, to relieve their sufferings, and to give them a chance to approach Krishna. So, I'll stop there. Thank you very much. The note that endorses questions and everything should end by 8:30, so maybe I shouldn't ask you questions. It's okay? You know?
Yeah, it's okay because it's okay. During the college time. The college is over, right?
College is over. So, okay, maybe if any brief question or comments, anybody might
have. Because the students, they have to, before, during the college, students will need to have them, so.
Okay.
It's okay.
Yes, brother.
Okay. Yesterday we were reading with the devotees and we were speaking about this, the fifth canto. It explains all the universe, where the planets are and everything. And we can see that in the school they teach us that the people from the United States arrive at the moon. And they said that the moon is closer than the sun. But in the fifth canto we look at and we find that the moon is two times bigger than the sun, and the sun is closer. And Prabhupada makes an explanation, says that the scientists always change the meters and always change all these things, but the Vedic science is always remained for a long time. So in this way, how is possible that they can teach us this in school?
How is it possible they can teach you that in school?
Yeah, because the normal would be that they can teach us this and also the Vedic science, complete science, but not, it's like hiding something in school. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people grow with this in mind. They believe that they reach the moon and they believe that the sun is like this, but in the Vedic culture, if you have luck, you can find this and say, okay, this is a completely different information.
So I'm not sure exactly what your question is, but on the basis of those two points, you can have very different questions. So you said you're asking, why is it they teach it in school?
Yes.
Is that the question?
Yeah.
Really? That's the most important question on those points? That may be the most difficult question. Why are they teaching in school? I don't know why they teach in school. One thing I know, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, according to one's desire, he gives you a faith. Right? People have different desires, so he gives us a faith that by acting out that desire we'll be happy. I worked in a factory before I became a devotee, and I rode to work every morning with one man whose life was based on the faith that when he bought a Harley-Davidson motorcycle, he'd be happy. And every day, 5 o'clock in the morning for 1 hour, he'd tell me about the motorcycle he was going to buy. And it was a very expensive motorcycle. It meant like 2 more years he had to work in his hellish factory to get a motorcycle. And I was thinking, I have a motorcycle. I'm not happy. I know so many people that have motorcycles. They're not happy. Why are you thinking? But he had a faith like that. So I don't know why they, I think the reason they teach it because they think it's true. They think it's accurate. I'm not enough, I don't know anything about science to be able to say how is it possible their instruments come up with that information. That I don't know. I remember being about 7 years old and watching, I went to a summer camp. I remember they gathered all the children in the big dining hall to watch on TV the moon landing. And we sat and watched and watched and watched, and then there was some kind of dark, very gray image came on, and somebody looked like somebody climbed off a ladder, and everybody applauded. And then we went out and went swimming again, which was much more fun than watching whatever was on TV. So, you know, I don't, as far as our perspective, I thought you were going to go to the other question, how do we understand those differences? And I just, my sense of that is that personally, I've never gone there. I've never tried to go. So it's all speculation for me. There's one group of people say we went, there's another group of people say that it's not possible. So I kind of look at it and say, okay, these are the people that told me if I eat, drink, and if I eat, drink, I'll be happy. Eat, drink, and be merry. Make money, become rich, become powerful, buy a big house, you know, get married, have children, and you'll be happy. So those are the same people told me that the moon is so close and that they went there. These other group of people, they're telling me these things won't make you happy. Actually, the greatest philosophers in the world understand that life is suffering. And if you chant God's name, you gradually become purified, you'll be more peaceful. So what they say seems to work for me. What they say doesn't seem to work. So as far as where's the moon, that's too much for me. But, you know, it's kind of like somebody says, okay, we're going to build a big skyscraper. And somebody else says, we're going to build a big skyscraper. And this person puts a bunch of sand on the ground and says, now we're going to build a big skyscraper. And you look and go, I don't think so. The sand's a little shaky. Somebody else puts a very, very nice foundation and says, you just come gradually, slowly, slowly, it's going to be better. I put more faith in that personally. And why they teach it, they obviously believe it's true. And generally, people, you know, we understand, we apply, we teach things according to what we know. You know, it's not like they're consciously thinking, okay, you know, let's deceive everybody. There may be a few people like that, but that's very small. Most people, you know, that teach science classes, they're just trying to feed their kids. But that's what they understand. But I do remember from my own experience when I was studying some science in high school and in university, I remember being very, very surprised that for 2,000 years almost, all intelligent people accepted Aristotelian ideas about the structure of the universe and the atom. And then sometime around 1400 or something, they realized that wasn't accurate. They came up with a whole new set of information. They taught that for 150 years. Then they came up with some new information. They taught that for 50 years. Then they came up with something different. And each time they did it, more or less contradicted. So I can remember consciously thinking, so if I was born in the year 800, I would have been trained to believe that. And now you're telling me it's false. So all the authorities that would have accepted them in the year 1200, but then in 1300, they would have told me I was a fool. But then in 1400, they told me I was a fool because of that. I mean, I'm not exactly, it was like that, you know. And then all the way up to 1972, when I was in high school and a couple of years in university, and they're saying, but today, you're lucky. Because we know. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, 50 years from now, they didn't think how stupid we were. Right. Like you read about like the people in the 50s and things when they first found, you know, maybe earlier 30s, they first found radioactive materials and they thought it was really a cool thing to do to put it in people's watches because it glowed at night. And now we think, how stupid, radioactive materials. Right? So like in America, everybody's eating their food in microwave ovens thinking how convenient it is. A lot of people are thinking 20 years from now, they're thinking, how stupid. I grew up, I have a mouthful of, I don't know if they use them here, they call them silver fillings. They're not silver, they're made from aluminum and all these things. And now the health people say that's the worst thing. They say worst yet is to take them out, so, you know, so, but that's what they thought. You know, the dentist, they thought they were doing a good job on the basis of their knowledge. So therefore, Prabhupada says they're always changing. We think it could be like this, maybe that. But ultimately, I think it boils down to the most important things in life, how we're going to spend our time. We base that on things that we can test, we can experience. So, you know, materialistic people, they're saying do things that are harmful, so who wants to do those?
If I understood correctly, he was saying that in Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, it said that the moon is twice as big as the sun, and it's further away.
That's what he said, yes.
When there's a solar eclipse, it's like you can see the moon is going in front of the sun. If the moon would be bigger than the sun, you wouldn't see the whole thing. So I don't understand, you know, if it's so, then there's something in Srimad Bhagavatam which isn't so.
Yeah, you have to look. I don't know those sections so much. And there's lots of
I'm
things.
I'm not there yet.
Yeah, you can look forward to that.
Yeah.
Also, Sariputta Prabhu has written quite a few books on some of those things, so you can look and study. I mean, there's whole projects done with the Mayapur temple development. They're studying that very in-depth, how they're going to portray answers to these different questions. But I think from the things I saw Sariputta Prabhu make a few presentations as he was analyzing the Vedic description of the universe, and it seemed at least as logical as what I remember learning from the Western scientists. At least as much. And it's coming from the Bhagavatam, so again, we know everything else they're saying here makes so much sense. I mean, those same people telling you where the moon is, then they're the same people that use the same instruments to go out and make slaughterhouses. And, you know, they do horrible, horrible things, so it raises some doubt in our mind. Yeah. Okay, from the lady's side.
Just to confirm that, as far as I understand, the question of the moon is, and
modern scientists haven't even discovered, so that's interesting. that's very interesting. Okay, we'll stop. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.